Today on KPR Presents, the best new books by Kansans or about Kansas. I'm Kay McIntyre. Each year, the State Library of Kansas selects 15 books as Kansas Notable Winners. In the first of a two-part series, we'll hear from the authors of many of those books, including fiction, nonfiction, poetry, young adult literature, and more. It's my favorite show of the year, a chance to read some good books, meet the authors, and give some books away. Later this hour, find out how you can win a Kansas Notable book. We'll start with To Leave a Shadow, a gritty detective novel set in 1937 Wichita. The author, Michael Graves of Emporia. The protagonist, Pete Stone, a hard-boiled private eye in the Philip Marlowe Sam Spade model. Mike, tell us about Pete Stone.
Well, thank you for mentioning Philip Marlowe and Sam Spade, because I did have those characters in mind when I wrote this. However, Pete Stone, the reason I wrote this and the reason I chose Pete Stone was because I was thinking of a grandfather that I didn't know very well. And my grandfather's last words to my father were, "Tell the boys not to forget me." And the boys were my brothers and myself. And those words have stayed with me through the years. But as I've gotten older, I realized that I didn't forget the words, but I felt like I never knew my grandfather. And 1937, that was part of his era. So I put him in his hometown of Wichita, where he lived, and I made up a story. And that's how he came to be. His name was Pete Graves. I didn't want to use that. I thought of Graves, gravestone, stone, Pete Stone.
What a cool story.
Thank you. He's important to me even more, I think, today as I grow older. Because of you know, I think the words "tell the boys not to forget me," there's probably not too much that's remarkable about those. I think we all have a desire to leave something that is remembered, and I wanted him to leave a shadow. So that's how the book came to be.
In classic detective novel form, the story begins when a woman walks into the office looking for her missing husband, Sidney Hamilton. Take it from there. Give us a little snippet of the plot.
Well, part of the backstory is based on truth. My grandfather was divorced, and he remarried Lucille. And so I wanted him to meet Lucille at this time in Wichita. And Lucille Hamilton is a woman, very determined woman. The description that I give in the book is very much as I remember my grandmother. She was bird-like, very small, very tiny, but determined, had a tough little jaw that she would set, and she was determined that she was going to see things through. She was looking for her husband, who had gone missing, and she had gone to the police, she had gone to other detectives. And remember now, this is 1937 Wichita, and it was not unusual for men to take a lamb. You know, things would get awfully tough during the Depression, and so they would take off, they would leave. And since there was no sign of foul play, no one was willing to take up this woman's project and look for her missing husband. Pete Stone was the last one on her list, and he said he would do it. So that's how that came to be.
To Leave a Shadow isn't just a great detective story. It's a walk through Wichita history from Stearman Aircraft and Boeing all the way down to the car that Pete Stone drives. Tell us about that car.
Sure. He drives a Jones Roadster, and the Jones company was in Wichita for a very brief period of time in the 1920s, 1919, I think, until the 20s. And it was a very successful car company, but unfortunately suffered a fire. It was burned down, and they were just too far behind. They couldn't rebuild. So they built these cars for about 6, 7, 8 years, and that just came about. The reason I chose that was because I took my dear wife Monica, and we started researching a little bit about things in Wichita. And when we went to the Sedgwick County Historical Museum, we found a Jones Roadster, and I said, that's his car. That's what it has to be. And so that's how that came about. And then we went down. My grandfather did work and retired from Boeing. I have no idea what he did for Boeing, but I know he worked for Boeing. So I wanted the aircraft industry to be prevalent in this novel. And we went to the Air Museum on the south side of Wichita, and there was the Stearman trainer. And I said, that's got to come into the story. So all of this, I am not an expert on Wichita history, but I had so much fun researching this. I started with the library, the main library, reading old issues of the Wichita Eagle, which my father delivered. That was his first job when he was a boy. I wanted to make sure that the Eagle played a strong part in this. I started there. I found an old map almost of in the 30s. It's a 1941, I believe, map of Wichita. So I had the streets. And then I began plotting where I wanted the story to take place by using that. And so much just fell into place. We stopped in to a little sandwich shop on Seneca that is called Merle's today, but in 1930s it was Tom's Place, and it was a beautiful little bar. So that's where Pete hangs out quite often, stops in for a sandwich and a beer. So that became central to the story, a place for him to be. And then my good friend Kevin Rabus, who's a jazz drummer, lent me a book on jazz in Wichita during that era, and I found some of the clubs and some of the people who were playing back then and worked them into the story also. The Calico Cat, the Gage Brewer Band. Those were real names, real places, real people back in that time. And what I found when I read the newspapers, it was so much of it was, of course, unique to the 1930s, but so much of it was relevant today. The same stories. Then we knew that the country, or people, some people knew that the country was in real trouble because we had liberal Roosevelt in office. We had auto workers on strike in Detroit. We had violence in schools. I couldn't believe it. I actually came across a story of a, and I did not use this in the novel, but I came across a story of a young boy who took a gun to school and shot a teacher. I mean, some of the things that we talk about today and we think are just so unique to our time really happened just the same back in the 1930s. So I found that fascinating, too.
Could I get you to read an excerpt?
Sure. I'm going to skip the first two pages because I would like to have the reader read that on his or her own. Pete Stone has just returned from a case. He's traveled to Chicago. It's been kind of a rough trip. It was a runaway case. And he's just returned back to his office, and he's reading the newspaper and waiting for something to happen, I guess. It's a Friday afternoon, and he's just wanting a little rest. He needs a little rest. And then she walks in. She opened the door and stopped at the threshold and looked around the room. I don't know what was running through her mind, but I could imagine. Maybe she expected comfy chairs and a few begonias decorating a coffee table. Maybe she assumed a secretary would smile and greet her with, "Good day, may I help you?" If that's what she thought, she must have been disappointed. I didn't have any of that. My office was an office. Nothing fancy, nothing frilly, and just the way I like it. I was its lone occupant. The lady scanned the decor. There wasn't much to scan. I had a desk, a couple of straight-back chairs, and a rack to hang my hat on. At that particular moment, my feet were up on the desk, and my hat was on the rack. Her eyes met mine, and she spoke. "Are you a private detective?" "That's what it says on my license. I'm still waiting on my secret decoder ring." "Funny," she said. I didn't think she meant it. "Are you any good?" "That depends on who you ask." "I'm asking you." "Then the answer is yes, but I confess to a slight prejudice." And then they go ahead and they visit. He realizes that she's a determined woman looking for her husband. She gives him the details, and I'll skip to toward the end of this section then. After she left, I glanced over my notes. They didn't look promising. Men had been running off for years now. Between the stock market crash, the Midwest drought, and the ongoing depression, many a strong man had broken under the strain. I replayed our conversation in my mind and tried to get a fix on Hamilton. I looked at his photograph and read over my notes, but I couldn't get a clear picture of the man. I thought of that Pulp Fiction character, The Shadow. Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men? Indeed, who knows? I looked out the window at the shadows falling over the city. Men wearing suits and hats and women in dresses and high heels scurried for cars and buses. The lucky ones were headed home to warm meals and loving families, looking forward to a bit of time away from work. Some weren't so lucky. I thought about Mrs. Hamilton going home to an empty house. She was afraid and alone. I considered my own situation. I wasn't afraid, but I was alone. I didn't have a family at home. There would be no hot meal waiting for me. What I did have were a client, some notes, and a few bucks in my pocket. What I needed was a clue.
That's To Leave a Shadow by Michael Graves of Emporia. Mike, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you, Kay. It's my pleasure.
From the gritty streets of Wichita to the sweetest book on this year's Kansas Notable list, our next book is Sun and Moon by Lawrence artist and illustrator Lindsay Yankee. We first met Lindsay last year when her book Bluebird was named a 2015 Kansas Notable winner. Great to see you again, Lindsay.
Thanks, Kay. Thanks for having me.
Like Bluebird, Sun and Moon is a children's book with gorgeous illustrations. Can you describe your style of artwork?
Sure. I suppose a good way to start describing it is I use a ton of different materials. I like oil paint, watercolor, pencil, linoleum cut, kind of anything goes to best suit each page and each illustration. So this book has a lot of different materials that vary from page to page, so a lot of variety.
I think I would probably use the word whimsical to describe your artwork.
Yeah, that sounds, I've heard that one before. I like that.
Okay. Sun and Moon is a lovely story about a conversation between, no surprise, the sun and the moon. Without giving away the plot, can you summarize it for us?
Sure. The idea behind it is the moon is jealous of the sun because he thinks that she gets to see everything cool. And so the book introduces all kinds of different scenes and animals that are unique to the nighttime to kind of show him his own world and kind of find a new value in it.
Could you read the first couple pages of Sun and Moon for us?
Sure. Just for one day, begged the moon. That was all he wanted. After a lifetime of darkness, Moon wished to spend just one day as the sun. At night, with everyone asleep, his world was often boring and lonely. Moon imagined that the sun saw beautiful sights like flowers blooming, children playing, and tigers sunbathing. I will trade my day for your night if you meet two conditions, Sun told Moon. First, if we trade, it will last forever, not just for one day. And second, you must spend the entire night in the sky looking very closely at the earth, closer than you ever have before. And only then may you decide if you want to trade places. Moon was thrilled. I promise to look closer than ever before, he told the sun. Moon hurried to his place in the night sky. As he rose on the horizon, he peered through the darkness, expecting to see nothing more than a sleepy world.
That's Lindsay Yankee reading from Sun and Moon, a 2016 Kansas Notable book. Lindsay, this is such a lovely story of yearning and watchfulness and the beauty of observation. Is there a story behind this book?
Yes. I started this story, well, the first idea for it was long ago in about 2004. And I was walking home from class here at KU, and it was a beautiful day, and the flowers were blooming, and the birds were singing, and the sun was out, and I just kind of thought, wow, man, the sun gets to see it all, and like, this is just amazing. And then it kind of got me thinking, well, what about the moon, and what does the moon get to see? And kind of approaching that challenge of what is special and unique to the nighttime that the moon witnesses that maybe we just aren't aware of and don't see under our noses.
Did you spend time, nights perhaps, wandering around taking a fresh look at what the moon sees?
Not exactly. No, I just kind of I kind of just sat down and started making a list of a lot of things that I think would be special to illustrate, and definitely some influence from one of my favorite books, The Little Prince. There's a shout out to the baobab trees and the lamplighter, and I was really in love with that book. I still am, but kind of working in with those references too.
Like I mentioned before, we first met last year when you came in to talk about your book, Bluebird. Are there similarities between that book and Sun and Moon?
I think so. Style-wise, this one just kind of has like a richer palette, I'd say. It's not as soft. It's a little bit more bold and kind of striking. But I have noticed that the two books that I've written and illustrated, we kind of go from place to place to place. And that's the way I like to tell stories, I suppose, and the way I like to illustrate. So that's definitely a strong similarity between the two.
It also occurs to me that in Bluebird, the protagonist was a bird that is looking at the world from on high. And here you have the Sun and Moon again looking at the world from on high.
Yes. Good observation. I don't know if I've even put that together of that kind of from far away perspective. Yeah.
Well, it's a lovely book and a wonderful addition to the Kansas Notable Book List. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Stephen Johnson is an artist who lives in Lawrence and teaches at the University of Kansas. He's also the author of several children's books, including Alphabet School, which was named a Kansas Notable Book. Welcome, Stephen.
Hello.
Before we talk about Alphabet School, let's go back to 1995. You published a book called Alphabet City, which won the prestigious Caldecott Honor. Tell me about that book.
That was a book basically out of my love affair with New York City and living in Brooklyn at the time, walking around and just discovering shapes and textures that I liked artistically just for their coloration and form and whatnot. And then I soon discovered that I could find letter shapes in a fire escape or, you know, bricks or whatever it may be. And so I had this little idea, and I pitched it one day sitting in my editor's office, my future editor, that is, at Viking Books off of Varick Street in Lower Manhattan. And they thought it was a great idea. And the funny little aside is that I thought to myself, okay. And she said, well, would you like a contract? And I said, well, let me think about it. And being a young hubristic dude, so by the time I got down to the subway, I'm like, what am I, an idiot? So I tried to find a working payphone and called her right back. Of course I'll do it. And so then what happened is I just started generating these paintings, which I never painted, these large pastel and watercolor paintings in a hyper-realistic manner, in order to convey the honesty of finding shapes, you know. And there's actually two from Lawrence. There's the Q is a railroad wheel from North Lawrence, and a V in our telephone poles. But anyway, so I just would do a painting, and it took me a couple weeks per painting, and then I would package up about four at a time in a big hefty bag, black hefty bag, so I could take them on the subway, and they sort of be incognito, and no one would, you know, spill coffee on it and stuff. So then I would take it into the office and present these every month or so, and everybody liked what they saw, and then eventually became the book and did very well.
Let's jump forward about a decade. I understand that the inspiration for Alphabet School came from your daughter and a peanut butter and jelly sandwich.
Yep, that's pretty much it. Also to address that, yes, so I would make these peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, and of course she would eat only the inside and not the crust. They'd come back in the little Tupperware thing, and then one day just two half pieces of peanut butter jelly sandwich were coupled together in the perfect uppercase G. So, and I photographed it and kept that in my archives. The other thing that was the inspiration for the school is just speaking to schools over the years and engaging students, particularly elementary school kids, and how their teachers and librarians used my Alphabet City book to engage the students in seeing their world differently. So I would get a lot of fan mail and things like that of schools. They would run around and try to find letter shapes in their schools. And some of them are quite good. In fact, the kids from Pinckney years ago came up with my letter U, which is an interesting one. It's the actual uppercase. It's a toilet seat up. Makes a perfect U. And it's actually the Pinckney toilet seat, because they have those old toilets in there. I mean, not to get too graphic, but they are kind of beautiful in that old-fashioned shape, you know. So that was an example of using inspiration from kids. And I went back to revisit my schools and wander around Lawrence. And in fact, they're all Lawrence-based schools. So each image has some New York school, Cordley, Quail Run, that kind of thing.
I'd love for you to pick out a couple pages from Alphabet School and describe the illustrations for me.
Sure. The letter C was a complicated image to do. It's one of my favorites. It's a globe on a shelf with a window, and it, for me, it represented my experience of going to my elementary schools and junior high, Central and Centennial Elementary. Anyway, you know, when you're a student, you're in the classroom and it's sunny outside and you're looking through that window and you kind of want to be outdoors and not indoors. It had that kind of a feeling. And it was Cordley, actually, before they remodeled it. And so being a globe, I, of course, had to create sort of the idea of the letter C. So I have a big ocean, and China is part of that. But the ocean makes an abstract shape. And then down below, there's a series of books. And I created a book that doesn't exist down below called C is for Continents, which has a graphic quality that reminds me at least of the Dr. Seuss books, and the way the typography was used and the simplicity of the covers, which I still adore. And then I plugged in some of my own books there on the, I have my Alphabet City book. I have a book called Love is Strongest Ginger that's about a grandmother and granddaughter, a Chinese story from San Francisco in the 50s. And so anyway, little things like that are hidden in the book. You mentioned the letter K. The K is from Pinckney Elementary, and in there it's a staircase, and I changed the tiles and things to make it more in my color palette. And then I used children's drawings that were sent to me based on a book that I did called My Little Blue Robot. So there's children's drawings pinned up on the wall. So things like that. I reuse some of my other books in a different way, if you will, inside the imagery. All, of course, this follows the same rules as the Alphabet City, capital letters in their natural position, and trying to find the most interesting aspects of schools, which isn't quite as, you know, sexy, if you will, as a New York City landscape, but still in all, there's a lot to be found, from hopscotch to windows to flagpoles to, you know, interiors to pencil sharpeners. The playgrounds are a wonderful place to find shapes. So anyway, there's nothing better than running around schools with kids trying to find and discover their world anew in hidden places. A lot of places we don't really care to look at. We just sort of go forward. But if we take a moment and stop and look at corners and then shadows and little pebbles or whatever, there's a magical world to be found.
Even in a toilet seat.
Even a toilet seat.
Stephen Johnson is an artist and author of Alphabet School. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
If you're just joining us, today on KPR Presents, it's the 2016 Kansas Notable Books, the best new books by Kansans or about Kansas, selected by the State Library. I'm Kay McIntyre. You're listening to KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio. Coming up, two books for young adult readers, including the story of Buffalo Bill growing up in Kansas. But first, Kansas Wildflowers and Weeds by Michael John Haddock of Manhattan, Craig Freeman of Lawrence, and Jeanette Baer of Littleton, Colorado. Craig Freeman joined me in the KPR studios earlier this week. Back in 1979, Jeanette Baer published Wildflowers and Weeds of Kansas. And in the introduction to your book, you say that since then, our understanding of flowering plants has undergone dramatic changes. How so?
Well, primarily, it's a result of changes in our understanding about how plants are related. So many names have changed in the last 30 years or so as a result of science being applied to understanding the relationships. And the other thing that has affected floras is that the flora is dynamic. And when I talk about the flora, I'm talking about all of the plants that occur in a particular area. It can also be used to talk about a book that describes all of those plants. And so the book is a flora. But when I talk about the flora of Kansas, I'm talking about all of the plants that occur around here. And so people tend to think of a flora as being static, not changing very much. But in fact, we see huge changes in the species that are represented around here. Things that are coming in from other sources, things that are disappearing. And so over a 30 or 40 year period, we find the need to take a look at what we published before and scrutinize it and account for all of those changes that have occurred in nomenclature and in species compositions.
All right, now you're taking me by surprise because it had never occurred to me that there have actually been changes in the plants that we see here in Kansas. Is that because of climate change or just that plants kind of come and go in terms of popularity?
They come and go in terms of popularity. That's one of the big factors that influences the flora. As an example, one of the things that I did when I was working on the book is to work with a lot of specimens that we have in the research collection here at KU. There's also a large collection over at Kansas State University. And those collections document the flora, the plant life of Kansas going back to the 1860s. And when you look at the species that were documented in Kansas for the last 160 years or so, we find that about 50 to 60% of the native species, the things that we thought were here when Euro-Americans arrived, were documented by 1900. And there hasn't been much of an increase in the native species in the last 40 or 50 years. We don't find very many new species in the flora. But when you look at the introduced things, things that have been brought in purposefully as ornamentals for food and fiber, or things that got here accidentally, the things that we like to call weeds, we see that number increase at a rate of about three, almost four species per year. And so that represents about 500 species during the last 160 years. These are species that weren't here when we first started to settle the state, and now they've become established as part of the flora. They're acting like they're characters that have been here for a long period of time.
Your book, Kansas Wildflowers and Weeds, is It's a big book.
It's kind of embarrassing.
It's a big book with lots of pictures in it. It's certainly not a field guide.
That's right.
How do you see people using this?
Yeah, just, you know, commenting about the size. One of these, you know, useless bits of information is the original book, Kansas Wildflowers, which was written by William Chase Stevens, who was a faculty member here and really is where this lineage starts. It was published in 1948. I think it weighed about 2.5 pounds. When Jeanette Baer's book was published, it had, you know, mushroomed to about 4 pounds. And Kansas Wildflowers and Weeds is now about 5 pounds. So if anybody's paying attention to the, where there's some recent statistics about obesity in the U.S., we followed that trend, unfortunately. So it's not the kind of thing that you would lug with you out into the field. You might leave it in the vehicle
the
with you. Yeah, that's right. Fortunately, there are guidebooks. Both Mike and I have published wildflower guides that are much easier to tuck into a pack and take with you out in the field. And if you find that you really can't pin something down, a lot of people take pictures or take them back to the car, take them home, and that's where you can use Kansas Wildflowers and Weeds. If you need a doorstop or a tornado shelter, you know, it might be useful for that as well. So there may be some advantages to it that we didn't think about.
It makes a nice coffee table book.
Yeah, that's where we usually see it. And, you know, we're really, really happy with the quality of the photographs. That's one of the things that we wanted to do is increase the number of photographs and go from mostly black and white photographs that were used in Jeanette's book to color photographs. And so the University Press of Kansas was really good in working with us to allow us to have, I think it was close to 850 color photographs. And we expanded the number of species that we treated from about 800 in Jeanette's book to close to 1,200 in Kansas wildflowers and weeds. So it really did bulk up, and that accounts for a lot of that additional weight, I think.
When I was looking through your book, Kansas Wildflowers and Weeds, I happened to be on a car trip at the time. My husband was driving, and I pulled it out, not really knowing what to expect, but I put it in my lap and I took a look at it and I leafed through it. I actually thought it was it was very interesting in the descriptions of the plants, as well as the photographs are beautiful. But what was really interesting to me was after I had spent some time flipping through the pages, I looked at the window of the car and I noticed wildflowers everywhere.
That's a pretty typical reaction from people who don't use floras or field guides routinely. It really impresses upon them the diversity that they've missed. We tend to look at the conspicuous things. We're driving down the highway
at
55 miles per hour or 70 miles per hour, and we can pick up the sunflowers. But do you know that there are a dozen different kinds of sunflowers, for example? Or these tiny little things that are hidden away amongst the grasses. And those are the kinds of things that you can talk about in a flora. You can provide descriptions, and you can give people hints about where to look for them, the kinds of habitats in which they occur. And it becomes sort of a game with a lot of people, a challenge for them to try to find these things as they're, you know, traipsing across the landscape. They want to see more of these things. And I think that works for plants and animals as well. So that's one of the real benefits of field guides and floras, is that it causes people to really take a much closer look at their surroundings and to try to find these things that they weren't even aware existed.
That was certainly my experience, and it was really eye-opening.
Good. Then it sounds like it worked perfectly in your case.
It worked.
Yeah.
Craig, your day job is you're the senior curator at KU's herbarium.
That's right, yes.
I didn't even know we had an herbarium here at the University of Kansas. What is that?
Basically, I joke about it as being a giant plant morgue. It's a research collection. We use it to document the plants that occur in this part of the world. So it's a collection of about 430,000 pressed and dried plant specimens. It's a very significant collection.
430,000?
Yeah, it ranks in the top 5% in terms of the size among more than 700 collections in North America. So it's a significant collection, but it's small by comparison to big collections like Missouri Botanical Garden or New York Botanical Garden or, you know, Kew or Paris, which may have 6 or 7 million specimens. But it's the largest collection of its kind in Kansas. There's also a collection at Kansas State University, and we use that to document the diversity of plant life through time. And so that's how we can look at these trends that have occurred in native and introduced plants. The specimens are shared with researchers around the world. We can ship the materials to individuals who want to study them, where they can come to the collection and work with them. They can obtain tissue from the specimens if they're interested in extracting DNA from the specimens. They can do that. We also have seeds in the collection. We have fruits in the collection. But most of what we have are pressed and dried specimens of flowering plants and ferns. A few fungi, some lichens, and a few other odds and ends as well.
Craig Freeman is the co-author of Kansas Wildflowers and Weeds, along with Michael John Haddock of Manhattan and Jeanette Baer of Littleton, Colorado. It's just one of 15 books that won the 2016 Kansas Notable Book Award, selected by the State Library of Kansas. Books for wildlife lovers, a gritty detective novel, children's books, there's something for everyone on the Kansas Notable Book List, including young adult readers or older readers who just love a good fantasy. Roderick Townley of Leawood is the author of many fantasy novels for young adults. I first met Roderick back in 2010 when his book Blue Shoe was named a Kansas Notable Book. His latest, A Bitter Magic, tells the story of 12-year-old Cicely Thummel. She's searching for her mother, the beautiful Marina Thummel.
Supposedly the most beautiful woman in Europe. disappears during a magic act. Marina and her brother Asa Thummel have a magic show they take around Europe, and they're very famous. And they're trying this new act out, and where she disappears on stage in front of the whole audience. And in fact, she does so, but she does not reappear at the end. And so suddenly her 12-year-old daughter, Cicely, is orphaned and is looking for her mother, looking for clues, walking by the ocean every morning at dawn with her pet lobster named Elwin, who is basically her only friend, until she meets a sort of rough-hewn kid from town. So that's the premise. And it gets pretty wild from there. Actually, it's, in a way, my most extravagant book. I've written 8 of these now, and there are shape-shifting labyrinths. There's a closet of whispering ball gowns that Cicely almost gets lost in. All the gowns are whispering, either to her or to each other. There's a mirror that doesn't reflect, but it does make things disappear. So I sort of went a little bit wilder than usual on that, and yet I found myself dealing with some simple, deep themes. For instance, a young girl's loneliness. Cicely has no friends, and her uncle Asa is occasionally cruel, but certainly cold and obsessed with his own things. I mean, after all, if your only friend is a lobster, you have some social problems.
As you said, Cicely's orphaned, and she goes to live with her uncle Asa in this mansion called the Crystal Castle. What's so special about the Crystal Castle?
Well, it's just one of those more extravagant ideas. It's made out of glass. And it has labyrinths outside and inside, so you can easily get lost either getting there or finding your way through. And Cicely has her room upstairs, up the crystal staircase. But, of course, the danger of living in glass houses is not only that people might throw stones, but that certain magical things might happen that would kind of mess things up. Not to speak of the ending, but a lot happens.
The irony, of course, is that you would think in a crystal house that very little would be hidden, and yet much is hidden and mysterious in the Crystal Castle.
Well, that's true, because Uncle Asa, who has designed this, has designed it to be as mysterious as possible, and in fact, they support it by giving tours of the place through dangerous crystal labyrinths that could at any moment turn into crystal daggers if you step on the wrong thing. So you would think it would be entirely invisible or permeable to sight, but in fact there are many secret areas in it.
You've already mentioned that Cicely has an unusual pet, Elwin the lobster. Why go that direction with sort of the one character that is going to ground Cicely as having a friend, even if it's a lobster?
You know, that was unexplained even to myself. I know that once I had a lobster, I said, aha, of course, and a nice thin golden chain on which she walks, this lobster. And the lobster seems to talk to her, and we don't know throughout the whole book whether the lobster is actually speaking or whether it's in her imagination because she needs someone and she imagines it, or could it possibly be her disappeared mother trying to communicate to her through this crustacean. And so I think that's unresolved even to the end, and I liked it that way. I really like to have an athletic book mentally so that the reader has to run around and see where the reader ends up. It may not be where I ended up.
Okay, but Roderick, why a lobster?
I don't know. I know why I got the name, Elwyn, it's always hard to name a character. And in fact, Cicely's name came to me because we know someone named Cicely Thummel, who was actually a journalist in Kansas City who was interviewing Wyatt, my wife, and I, for a local magazine. And I said, could I use your name? And she said, why would you do that? I'm not very interesting. And I didn't say, and I wouldn't have said, I know you're not interesting. I just want your name. But actually, she is interesting. But Elwyn, to pick up the thread, we were reading the letters, a 600-page book of E.B. White's letters. And it turns out that we didn't know it, but his first name is Elwyn Brooks White. And so as soon as I read that, I said, okay, there's my lobster. That's how you have to get a name. You have to get the character as soon as possible. And to get the character, it helps to get the name, right? And then you can learn out what that character would do, and pretty soon you have a situation. And after that, you finally have a novel.
Can I get you to read an excerpt from A Bitter Magic?
Oh, no, I don't read. I've never read. Okay. Well, I had anticipating this possibility, I have a few pages from the first chapter I might go with.
Perfect.
Here it is. Uncle Asa, Cicely's illusionist uncle, who's the star of his magic show. At the end of this magic show, he swoops on stage. For our final act, he calls out, we are proud to present an illusion never before attempted, one that's extremely dangerous. He scans the audience, then turns his head to the royal box. Tonight, for the first time, we dare perform it in honor of His Excellency the Archduke and his lovely consort. His Excellency nods solemnly. The lovely consort raises one brow. The music swells. Mother appears in a pool of light. In flowing silks and a white silk scarf around her shoulders, she stands perfectly still at the front of the stage, which has been built out into the audience. The crowd hushes. The scarf begins to ripple, although there is no breeze. Then little floating lights appear, swarms of them. She lifts her chin and stares into the audience. I lean forward. Slowly the tiny lights orbit Mother. Soon I notice there are fewer lights than before, and less of my mother. Parts of her dress, her arms, her hair are just not there. More lights disappear. More of my mother disappears. She's dissolving in front of my eyes. The audience begins to realize what's happening. Ladies peer through opera glasses. The Archduke, in his box across the way, gets abruptly to his feet. The last points of light blink out. The place where Mother stood is bare. That's not quite true. Her white scarf flutters down and drapes itself on the edge of the stage. An ovation erupts and continues for minutes. Uncle Asa returns, bows deeply, blows a kiss to the cheering audience, then turns, his arm extended toward the wing, welcoming his sister on stage. His arm remains extended, but he does not appear. Marina, he calls out above the tumult of the crowd. Come out, they want to see you. No, Marina. The applause dies down, but Mother continues not to appear. I think my beautiful assistant is playing with us, Asa says with a laugh. Come now, Marina dear, your audience awaits. No, Marina Thummel. Murmurs ripple through the crowd. The Archduke speaks to one of his aides, who nods and hurries off. Abruptly, the stage curtain jerks closed. A moment later, I hear a loud crash, like glass breaking. I'm out of my seat and running. I know my brain isn't working right, because the same crazy words keep churning inside me. Mother! My mother has evaporated.
That's A Bitter Magic by Roderick Townley. Thank you so much and congratulations, Roderick.
Oh, thank you. A lot of fun.
Andrea Warren of Prairie Village is the author of numerous award-winning books for young adults. Her latest, The Boy Who Became Buffalo Bill, Growing Up Billy Cody in Bleeding Kansas. Most of us know Buffalo Bill as the greatest showman of his time, the star of the Wild West show with cowboys and Indians, daredevil riding tricks and the like. And many people know of Buffalo Bill's time riding for the short-lived Pony Express. But your story opens when Billy Cody is just 8 years old when his family moved to Kansas. Why start there?
It was the turning point for the Cody family. The year before that, they'd been living on a very prosperous farm in Iowa. Billy's father, Isaac, was very much an anti-slave person. He didn't believe in it. He didn't want to see the extension of it anywhere. And that plays into the story, too. The family went through a terrible tragedy when Billy's older brother was killed in a riding accident. And the family just needed a change of everything in their lives, especially Billy's mother. So the father decided that this was the time. He was a bit of a wanderer. He was an entrepreneur. He'd had various kinds of jobs, lots of skills. Really a Western man himself, and he decided it was time to come to Kansas Territory. They were opening it up for settlement, and the first people in would get the best property. He had a brother who lived in Western Missouri, and this is what brought the family out as homesteaders.
When they meet Uncle Elijah, the brother that lives in Weston, it really has a pretty profound impact on their family.
Well, Uncle Elijah is a slaveholder. He's a wonderful man, and he was very supportive of his brother and his family, but he believed in slavery. So this is very much divided the brothers, although they stayed close. They just sort of had one of those agreements. This is the topic we don't talk about.
Billy Cody's life reads like a who's who of Kansas history. He meets abolitionist John Brown, Governor Charles Robinson. How did his family, especially his father, get pulled into that whole free state, slave state debate?
Well, the family settled in the Salt Creek Valley outside Leavenworth, and they were one of the very first families to live there. And Isaac made an assumption that the people who were moving into Kansas Territory at that time would all be opposed to slavery, and that when it came to a vote, Kansas would be a free state. And he was taken by surprise to find out that a lot of the new settlers coming in were pro-slave. A lot of them were coming in from the South for that very reason. They were coming in from Missouri, and they had a lot of claim jumpers coming in from Missouri, too. And they were a problem because they could go to the polls and vote. Nobody was asking for any kind of identification or addresses at that day. So they'd just say, oh, I live here now, and vote whichever way they wanted to do. And in the beginning, Isaac kept his views to himself because he was trying to establish a farm, and he had six children to support, and he just had too much else going on. And because his brother was well known in that area and was a slaveholder, the pro-slavers just assumed that these were Isaac's views as well. But one day he got cornered, and a drunken mob insisted on knowing how he felt about this, and he was never a man to back down. Billy was with his father that day and writes very movingly about this experience of his father being stabbed and then the attempt to save his life to get him to Weston to a doctor. And he did recover, and I have to put recover in quotes because he never fully recovered. That injury, the knife had sliced through one of his lungs, and he was never a truly healthy man again. He was very prone to infection. And 3 years later, he actually died from that. So this is, you know, a tremendous sacrifice for the Cody family in the service of trying to make Kansas a free state. And Billy's mother was very much a unionist, but she was not willing to sacrifice another family member, and that's where she gets into conflict with Billy as he gets older, because he wants revenge, as so many Kansans did, and Missourians did too, and this whole border war starts heating up.
Andrea, I'm embarrassed to admit this, but until I read your book, I didn't realize that Buffalo Bill had this Kansas connection.
I don't think many people do. There's sort of this tug of war on who gets to claim Buffalo Bill, because he spent much of his adult life in Wyoming and founded the town of Cody and was such a proponent for Yellowstone. He helped get the first highway into Yellowstone because he was good friends with Roosevelt and got him to do it. If you go to Wyoming, Buffalo Bill's picture is on everything that has to do with the state. I mean, he is Wyoming. But if you go to Iowa, he was born near LeClaire, and they claim him. They have a Buffalo Bill Museum. They have Buffalo Bill Days. If you go to Nebraska, if you go to North Platte, he had his adult home there for a long time. And this is where his wife, Louisa, made her headquarters, and where the children were and where the children went to school. And Cody had a huge ranch there and called it Scout's Rest Ranch, built a beautiful, beautiful Victorian home in the town and another Victorian home on the ranch. The Victorian from town doesn't exist anymore, but the ranch is very much as it was, and it's now the Buffalo Bill State Park, and they have the Buffalo Bill Days. So Nebraska has a huge claim on him too, and I'm a Nebraskan by birth, and I always thought Buffalo Bill was a Nebraskan. But I wanted to write about the border war. I've been in Kansas now for the last 30 years, and this is my home now. I was living in Old West Lawrence when I was a graduate student at the University of Kansas, and would see the markers about Quantrill and all of these things and think, I don't know any of this history. And I love history. And so the first thing I did was I wanted to write about the border war. I just felt that there was so much material there, and that most Americans think the Civil War started back east. We know it started right here. And finding a child through whom I could tell my story, because that's the way I write history, turned out to be a big challenge. And when I came to the material about Buffalo Bill and I read about his childhood, it was so rich. I felt it was a real gift, because he spent the years from age 8 to 20 right here in our area.
In writing about his childhood, is there one incident that you can point to that speaks to what the future Buffalo Bill will be like?
I'm going to pick the Pony Express. He was only 14 when he wrote it, and usually they were looking for 16 to 18-year-olds. They wanted skinny orphans. And Bill at that time was supporting his family. His father died when he was 11. He was now the breadwinner. He had five sisters and a baby brother, and there just weren't many jobs that women could get, women and girls. And so he was the one who was employable. And he started learning skills by working for Russell, Majors, and Waddell out of Leavenworth, herding cows, taking care of the horses, and then gradually starting to go on supply trains going west. He was fascinated with Native American culture. He learned their languages. He was fluent in several of them. And the skills he learned as a trapper, a hunter, a guide, he was just the all-purpose Western man. But I'm using the word man when he was 11 and 12 and 13 years old. And at 14, when Russell Majors Waddell started the Pony Express, he wanted that job because it paid $100 a month. And that was far and away the best money to be made anywhere for anyone. And so, you know, he wrote it less than a year because it wasn't in business for very long. But he encountered everything, chased by Indians, lying flat on his horse, knowing that they would try very hard to avoid hitting the horse with their arrows, going through blizzards and heat, drought, everything you can name was out there on the trails, riding hard and riding fast. And he always claimed he loved every minute of it. His mother didn't. She was afraid he was going to be shaken to death.
Do you have an excerpt that you'd like to read for us?
I don't think it's well known that Billy Cody, as he was known then before he became Buffalo Bill, it was railroad workers who gave him the name Buffalo Bill because he was such a crack shot. He could bring down a buffalo with one shot, and they'd never seen anybody do that before. But when he was a teenager, from when he was 16 and 17, and before he enlisted in the Kansas 7th and fought in the Civil War for Kansas, he was a Jayhawker. And in that part of it, in the beginning, he was just going out and stealing horses because horses were always in short supply. And there were so many raids going on across the border that Missourians were doing on Kansans and stealing horses that he felt very justified in doing that. Now, when his mother found out, she was a religious woman. She wasn't going to have a son of hers involved in thievery, and so she put a stop to it. But then things got a lot worse, and now it wasn't just horse stealing. Now these bushwhackers were coming across the border and burning out people's homes as well as stealing their horses, but they were killing. I mean, there was a great deal of violence going on around the border, and Billy wanted revenge. You know, they'd already killed his father in his eyes. They had destroyed the family home and created so much hardship. And his mother had also made Billy promise that he wouldn't join the army. You had to be 18 legally, but all you had to do was step up to the recruiter and say, I'm 18. You could be 16, and they'd take you because they needed cannon fodder. So I'm going to read a real quick excerpt here about how Billy becomes one of the Red Legs, and they were the most violent of the Jayhawkers. The family is still living on the farm in the Salt Creek Valley near Leavenworth at this time. Though he kept his promise to his mother not to join the army, bushwhackers were threatening the area, and it needed to be defended. Billy had turned 17 when he became a Jayhawker once again. This time, he was open about it with his mother. I felt I could join without breaking my promise not to enlist for the war, and join it I did, he said. He rode with one of the most infamous Jayhawker bands of them all, the Red Legs. The name came from the red stockings its members wore while on a mission. The leader of Billy's group was a cold, hard man, Captain Bill Tough, who had a reputation for cruelty. He had been known to hang captured bushwhackers. We had plenty to do, Billy reported. The Missouri guerrillas were daring fellows and kept us busy. They robbed banks, raided villages, burned buildings, and looted and plundered. But the Red Legs did the same. When they crossed into Missouri, they didn't care which side their victims supported. The Red Legs are decimating the country. They have no respect for any person's political opinions, one Missourian said. A historian noted that a full recital of their deeds would sound like the biography of the devil. Both Kansans and Missourians were forming home guards or militias to try to protect themselves and their property from bushwhackers and Jayhawkers. Billy's family thought he was involved only in protecting Kansans and their property. Julia, here's an aside, she's Billy's sister, naively commented that the Red Leggers were proud that despite numerous provocations, they did not copy the enemy's tactics but restricted themselves to purely defensive fighting. It's doubtful that Billy set her straight. We were the biggest group of thieves on record, he later admitted. He said little of his participation, merely commenting that we had many a lively skirmish with the bushwhackers, and when we were not hunting them, we had a very festive time. We ran things to suit ourselves.
That's the boy who became Buffalo Bill, growing up Billy Cody in Bleeding, Kansas. I've been visiting with Andrea Warren of Prairie Village. Thank you so much, Andrea.
Thank you. It's been a delight to be here.
The Boy Who Became Buffalo Bill, A Bitter Magic, Alphabet School, Sun and Moon, To Leave a Shadow, Kansas, Wildflowers and Weeds, just a few of the 2016 Kansas Notable Book Award winners, the best new books by Kansas authors or about Kansas, selected by the State Library. Do join us next week on KPR Presents when we'll have more Kansas Notable Books and their authors. In the meantime, if you'd like a chance to win a copy of a Kansas Notable book, we've got several to give away. Go to our website, kpr.ku.edu, look under Extra, and then Available Giveaways. Again, that's kpr.ku.edu, click on Extra, and then Available Giveaways. I'm Kay McIntyre. KPR Presents is a production of Kansas Public Radio at the University of Kansas.